Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Dan, what's going on, man?
Pat, it's season three.
It is season three. It is.
My gosh.
Carlos, how's
Finally.
It going, bud?
Good.
Good.
What's up?
Yeah, so we're here. Season three. We've made it.
Where have we been?
Where have we been? There's been a lot going on. Floods in basements, babies born.
That's right.
Insurrections.
Root canal. I had a root canal. That was fun, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, just grateful to be out of pain after that one. But anyway. A lot's going on politically as well. We finally have some quiet in terms of the news media is no longer tracking Twitter 24/7 to find out what the orange buffoon has said because the orange buffoon has lost his Twitter microphone.
So we're leaving.
Pat, I heard a rumor that you got banned from Twitter. Is that true?
No, not yet. I've been watching myself lately
okay.
with all the
okay. that is
people
just a
who have
nasty
been banned
rumor.
From Twitter. Yeah, that's just a nasty rumor at this point.
The far left is really coming for you.
Well, speaking of the far left, there has been some criticism of AOC, which I won't get into. And if Dito were here, he would be quite upset.
That's his girl.
To recap it. Right. So Dito's girl, AOC, she skipped the inauguration. She wasn't there. And, you know, true to form for AOC, she decided to show solidarity with people from her district who were on strike. The union of workers who work at Hunts Point Grocery Outlet were on strike. They were asking for just a dollar more per hour during a pandemic that has killed five of their fellow workers and sickened many more. And management returned, I think, an offer of like 39 cents per hour. So they went on strike, and only a few days after AOC showed up with them, they won. I don't know if they hit that dollar mark. I don't think they've publicized the outcome, but it was to the liking of the union. So it was much closer to that dollar than management had been before. So that's a success, and I think we see that across the country when workers stand up in solidarity and make it clear that they won't budge. They end up winning fights like that. So
people were mad that she wasn't at the inauguration?
No. I don't really want to get into it, but some people have been they wanted to push her to not vote for Pelosi for the speakership unless she agreed to bring Medicare for All to the floor of the House for a vote. And that just seemed like just not the time to be fighting that one out for me. I think Medicare for All is urgent. It needs to happen, but we need to make sure the support's there before we try to push that to the floor for a vote.
Right.
And so they kind of started talking about the fraud squad and all this stuff about how she wasn't staying true to her roots. And I think that's just premature. And I think just demonstrated by her showing up at the strike to stand out in the cold with workers who were on the picket line as opposed to going to the inauguration just shows where her heart's at. You know, she is still on the worker's side. She still has our back.
Yeah.
But, you know, Bernie has a new role, Dan. You know what Bernie's doing in the Senate these days?
Yes. He's giving out the top 10% to the lower 99%. And I can't wait.
That's not a bad Bernie.
I think he
right
doesn't
there.
Give a shit about the protocols of the Senate and like and pushing stuff through regular order. I think he's going to use the budget reconciliation route. And I think, someone like Schumer, frankly, would never do that. I think he would be too he's too parliamentarian, you know.
Yeah.
I think Bernie's going to do what he needs to do, and if people don't like it, but do you think he's going to have to, kiss Joe Manchin's ass and, Kristen Sinema, some of those moderates?
Yeah, I mean, I do think they they make it a little bit trickier, you know, especially Joe Manchin and his proclivity for kind of siding with the right, or at least trying to stay as close to the middle as possible. But, you know, Bernie, as Senate Budget Committee chairman, has a lot of power right now. And I think, like you say, Dan, I don't think he's going to be afraid to use reconciliation whenever possible. So reconciliation right. can't be used for everything, but anything that can be tied to the budget, he can decide to push through with reconciliation, which only requires over 50% vote as opposed to the 60-vote majority for other things to pass. So I'm going to be watching closely to see how often he uses that to, mm-hmm. I mean, literally just to get help to families that need it and things like that, or to help workers in situations where the Senate has not been standing up for them for the last 4 years. So I'm excited about that position that he's in right now.
Can't wait for
that. Yeah, and I think it also saves them from having to do all this, what do they call it, like horse bargaining, where you know, you say, fine, I'll, like what they did with the Obamacare, where they had to put in all these poison pills so that people would vote for it.
Right.
Like, you can just skip all that bullshit and just do what needs to be done without having to, you know, make a whole bunch of friends on the other side.
Well, yeah. I mean, the ACA was so fraught that they actually used reconciliation to get it passed, but they did still need to put in those poison pills and all the things that, you know, people on the left aren't super happy with, just because they had to convince over 50 senators to vote for it. So
right.
that was a tough one.
So, Pat, we had a new president. He's, you know, picking his cabinet, picking whoever he wants. Is anybody of interest to you?
Well, there's one that is particularly exciting to me because of, well, for many reasons, but it stands in the way of poetic justice, really. And that is Deb Haaland is picked for Secretary of Interior. And she was a congressperson, and she is also a Native American. And I think it's a sign of progress for the country, but it's also having her use that lens of having been raised Native American, and the choices that she'll make to protect the interior of the country and to protect, you know, our natural landscape. For instance, she pushed Biden to cancel the Keystone XL pipeline, which I think people have been waiting for years to hear something like that done by our government. It, for once, you know, our executive branch is standing up for the environment and standing up against big oil, big gas, big coal. And I just hope, you know, that she continues to put that pressure on Biden, and that we see other, you know, similar pipelines get canceled as well. Because, you know, I just think that they have a potential to do a lot of damage. We've seen some leaks in some of those pipelines, and they run right through Native American lands. They run right through just like pristine landscapes that we just don't want to put at risk at this point. And it also, you know, that collection and distribution of gas is only contributing to, you know, global warming, to global climate
change.
Yeah,
it's so refreshing. It feels like we haven't seen something like this in, I don't know, 4 years or so, where people are appointed who absolutely deserve to be there and who you know would be, you know, guardians of, you know, that office.
Right. I mean, we talked a few episodes ago about Antonin Scalia's son running the Department of Labor, and he had spent his entire career right. fighting against labor issues. And that seemed like, you know, that wasn't the exception. That was the rule for Trump's picks for cabinet secretaries, where that they had spent their careers kind of against. Working against right. the position that they were then going to hold. And I just, you know, I really look forward to seeing what Deb Haaland can do. And for folks who don't know, the Department of Interior has been responsible historically for, you know, mass genocide of Native Americans, of slaughtering, you know, hundreds of thousands of bison to force Native American tribes onto reservations so that, you know, corporations could take that land, or so that, you know, white European Americans could take that land. So it's just kind of a beautiful thing to have someone from a Native American background take that position and use that lens to guide them in their, you know, service of that position.
And you know, it's cool too, from an environmental standpoint, because I'm a wicked tree hugger. I was just actually hugging a tree right before we came on the air. Is that Trump had over 100 executive orders which peeled back environmental regulations. And because they were too lazy to put it through the legislative process, Biden can go and flip all those.
Right, right. And we're seeing him do that. Yeah, I think because of the fact that Trump relied so heavily on the executive actions, we're seeing Biden be able to undo those just as easily as Trump, signed them into being. Absolutely.
So, Patrick, who's coming on the show today? We're launching season 3 with like an innovator, like one of those names that we're probably going to be hearing about for quite a long time.
I hope so. Yeah. So, I sat down and interviewed Mayor Colin Byrd, who's mayor of Greenbelt, Maryland. He's the youngest Black mayor in the U.S., also a member of Greenbelt City Council. And he's also of note because he recently announced that he's going to run in the Democratic primary against Steny Hoyer.
Oh, damn it. Not Steny Hoyer. That dude's my fave. I was actually him for Halloween a few years ago. They were like, "Are you Steny Hoyer?" And I was like, "You got it."
He just showed up.
I just dyed my hair.
He just showed up to a place. Like, that's what he did.
There's Steny.
Well, he's held that seat. He's held that seat for over 20 years. Steny Hoyer has, and I think you'll hear in this interview, Mayor Byrd makes a really good case for getting someone who is not white into that position, and someone with some new, fresh ideas. And I think Mayor Byrd has those fresh ideas. So, you know, check it out. He's got a lot to say.
Exciting.
Stay tuned.
Our guest on this episode is Mayor Colin Byrd. He's mayor of Greenbelt, Maryland. He's the youngest Black mayor in the U.S., a member of the Greenbelt City Council, and has announced a run for U.S. Congress, announcing his run against Steny Hoyer, who has held that seat for over 20 years. Welcome to Trickle Down Socialism, Mayor Byrd. Could you start by explaining to our listeners what got you involved in politics so early in life?
Well, first of all, Mr. Donahue, let me just say thank you so much for having me on. And before I get started, I want to do what I've made a commitment to do anytime I can remember it. And that is by shouting out PG County, shouting out Charles County, shouting out all the CD5, and also shouting out D.C. And the reason I shout out D.C. is because there is no PG County without D.C. We are the sons and daughters, the grandsons and granddaughters of D.C., if you know the history. And I have to shout out D.C. as well, because we can't begin a conversation in my mind about federal legislation without acknowledging the present, ongoing, unacceptable injustice that is taxation without representation for our neighbors right next door in the nation's capital when it comes to their lack of representation in Congress. So yeah, you asked me how I got involved. A lot of people who know what I'm doing right now would probably presume partially correctly that I'm in some ways inspired by the ascension of Barack Obama to the presidency. Black man rose to the highest levels of politics. I came up as a young Black man pretty much through his tenure as president. And so I got to witness that firsthand. But if I were to tell you the truth, although he was partially inspirational, probably not for the traditional reasons that people might assume. When he was elected, of course, it represented to many in America a sign of tremendous positive racial progress. It was a celebratory moment for many people of color throughout the country. But I say this to say that when he became elected, I was cautiously optimistic. There were some signs even prior to his election that I should not be too optimistic, right? One of the things for me as a young Black man that I noted was the fact that race came up in his campaign. And when it came up, he was forced to disavow, as you may recall, his association with the then Reverend Jeremiah Wright.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah, and so Jeremiah Wright was telling the truth about America. He was telling the truth about America's unjust foreign policy, about America's unjust policies when it comes to race historically and presently. And because of that, and because he used some, let's say, colorful words to describe the fact that America can't get away with all of these things in a just world, he had to disavow himself of that. And so right then, I would tell you what I lamented then, and I continue to lament now, is that politics, unfortunately, from time to time, often telling the truth is a political liability. Yep. Telling the truth about tough issues is a political liability, and it's one that causes many politicians to say, you know what, let me not tell the truth about what's going on and about what's not going on. So anyways, how did I get involved? So I was 16 at that time. I couldn't even vote. And as an aside, I'll note that partly because of that experience and partly because of my experience as a city council member and now as mayor, I support allowing 16-year-olds to vote in federal elections, right? But as Obama was in office, I saw him accomplish a number of things of which I think the nation can be proud. But if I'm to be honest, both locally on the campus and across the country, there were a lot of very, very unsettling things happening during the course of Barack Obama's presidency. But I'll tell you the tipping point, Mr. Donahue, was the killing of Trayvon Martin and all of the injustice in and around it. We felt like that could happen to us, right? You go into the convenience store, you're just walking on your way home. And your only crime is walking while Black. He had Skittles and iced tea. I mean, I related to it almost too much, to be honest with you. And then to watch the trial and everything that happened in terms of how they painted him in every which way, both before and after the trial, it troubled me greatly that this is what we do in this country. This was not a new thing. This was a rerun. And now, the nation started to become more conscious during that trial and after that trial, but this was a rerun. I decided that I needed to get much more involved in activism, and I made a commitment then and there to really plunge, not with a toe, but all the way in to this fight against racial injustice. And I'll tell you that as part of that, I started out my politics being birthed out of Black Lives Matter and a commitment to making sure that myself and people like me, we didn't die at the hands of rogue civilians or rogue police officers, frankly. And then a lot of fights ensued in terms of just trying to make sure that we have this conversation about not only police reform, not only a criminal justice reform, but all manner of policies that perpetuate and promote white supremacy. I became Mr. Black Student Union. I became the head of government relations at the NAACP at Maryland. I chaired the Social Advocacy Committee of the Black Student Union at Maryland. But more than just dealing with issues of race, I began to learn and engage in the forming of multicultural coalitions on campus, coalitions that transcended race and also transcended gender, sex, and all forms of other identity. But if you want to know where the electoral politics piece came in, is as I was head of government relations, right, which is a fancy word for lobbyists, unpaid lobbyists, of course, people's lobbyists, of course. I noticed that whenever I reached out to elected officials to help for support on the various things we were advocating on, folks wouldn't listen. And they treated us like our issues didn't matter. And in the rare instances in which they did listen, they did so after being begged and begged and begged for extended periods of time. And I was very frustrated by that. And I could not accept that these folks were paid by us. They're paid by the people that they represent. And they're voted for by these individuals. And yet when you come asking for help, they are not there. They are not there when you need it most. And I will say that that wasn't the case with everybody. It was the rule, not the exception. I said, look, that cannot continue to be. Now, that didn't mean that I wanted to, at that time, be an elected official, but I did make it a commitment that if I could get certain people out that I didn't want, I would definitely participate in that process. You fast forward, we fought a lot of fights on campus. We won some, we lost some, but we learned a whole lot. And in particular, I learned how to be effective as well, not just to make a point, but to make a difference. That's an important thing, which, frankly, I do believe more progressives need to be mindful of and commit to. Notwithstanding that, the reason I ended up running for city council in particular, I'm from Greenbelt, a lifelong Greenbelter. I love my city. I love my community. It's same story, right? There were a number of issues that I was raising, other people in the community were raising, that were not being addressed. But the tipping point was the fact that actually people, people in the community wanted me to run. And the other thing was there was a long time a city council member who was retiring. And so there was going to be a vacancy on a city council that has had a lot of stability. So I ran, I won, and I'm speeding through that story. Winning is not as easy as 2 seconds saying I won, but that's what happened.
Right.
And the same thing with the mayoral, I noticed, and I have to be careful about this because I still work with some of these individuals, but I noticed that there was more that needed to be done, and it was a more responsive type of government that we could have with better leadership at the top of the city. And so that's really how I got involved in it. I can't say that it was just one issue that I ran on. Honestly, it had to do with service to the people. Just like why I'm running against Stanley, it's not one issue. That's to do with service to the people and about the fact that he is neglecting a number of the issues that matter to my community, my city, but also people all throughout this district. That's what it's about. And so we can get into specific issues, but I'm in it because I am not a politician who here and there will attend a rally. I am an activist who happens to be a politician. Mm-hmm. And as an activist, you know, who comes out of tradition of Frederick Douglass, which is power concedes nothing without a demand. I respect people who make demands of government. I respect people who passionately petition government for redress of grievances. When I ran, believe it or not, my campaign slogan was really what I was running on. And that was vote bird, your voice will be heard. It was about listening to people. And it was about serving them based on what you have learned from listening to them.
So I see your tagline in a few places, the audacity of progressives. And I like that. I haven't heard that before. It does kind of harken back to Obama and the audacity of hope a little bit. But I think it lines up actually pretty well with the mission of our show and what we're about in here on Trickle Down Socialism. But I was wondering if you could explain what you mean by that phrase, audacity of progressives.
The first president that I ever had an opportunity to cast a ballot in favor of was Barack Obama in 2012. I was not old enough in 2008. And so I frame a lot of my thinking about politics around some of the triumphs and challenges of the Obama presidency. I'm to the left of Barack Obama. He believed in the audacity of hope. And of course, that's what he talked about. And he also talked about reclaiming the American dream. When he wrote that book, The Audacity of Hope, the subtitle was Thoughts on Reclaiming the American Dream.
Mm-hmm.
And, what I believe, everything that has happened since Obama first got elected really shows us, if we sum it all up, is that we have deluded ourselves in some ways in America by focusing so exclusively on this notion of the American dream, past or present. The reality is the American dream that is often talked about, right, in American folklore, in the media, and even by President Barack Obama, whom I respect, it is alive and well for a very small group of people. But for most Americans, especially people of color, especially poor people, what people see more of than the American dream is the American nightmare. Mm-hmm. Crime, poverty, bad school, decrepit infrastructure, corruption, a broken economy. And so one of the mistakes of Barack Obama is I think he had more hope than was supported by the facts of America.
Right.
There's reasons for us to be deeply concerned about America, not just hopeful. Right. We do need hope. But what I believe and what God laid on my heart is that what we need now more than ever is not just the audacity of hope. It's the audacity of progressives. Now, what is the audacity of progressives? What I believe the audacity of progressives is this, right? It is the belief that change can't wait, right? If you look at many of the hot topics of our day, where there are dividing lines between the center of the Democratic Party and the quote unquote left of the Democratic Party, embodied by folks like AOC, Bernie Sanders, I don't believe that there is that much different about the goals. Everybody's going to say they want better education, right? Everybody's going to say they want crime to be resolved. They want police brutality to end. They want better transportation and infrastructure. They want changes in taxes. They want
access to healthcare.
They want access to healthcare. They want all of these things, right? But I believe that progressives understand that change cannot wait, right? We cannot be incremental about problems that are so long-standing and immediate and urgent, right? The pandemic is underscoring some of the urgency of these long-standing problems, right? We're now having important conversations about universal basic income, and we're seeing examples, small snippets of universal basic income through these stimulus check debates, right? That needs to be a long-term conversation to deal with the economic problems facing this country, because the reality is we're not in a temporary economic crisis created by the pandemic. The pandemic exacerbated an economic crisis that was longstanding and existing, right? Where you had this massive gap between the haves and the have-nots. So we need universal basic income. We need Medicare for all. We need a Green New Deal. Look, the difference between a progressive on the environment and centrist Democrats on the environment is, when do we get to 100% clean and renewable? And so the difference is, one side believes change can wait and is okay with that, or doesn't even believe that change is possible in the short term, right? Massive change. And the other side says, look, change can't wait. We need to accelerate this, because the reality is the earth is not going to wait for us to get our act together. And so that's why I talk about the audacity of progressives, because it has to do with this incremental approach to solutions versus, no, we need it now. We need it today, not tomorrow. Because guess what? We need it yesterday, not tomorrow. Right? All of the things that we're talking about right now, they would have been great ideas 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. Now they're not just great ideas. We're on the brink. And if we don't adopt these ideas, we're in big, big trouble as a country. And so that's why I talk about the audacity of progressives. The flip side to the audacity of progressives that I want to point out is that that one of the biggest mistakes of the progressive movement at large, not everybody in it, is that they believe and have operated as though they can capture the presidency, capture a Democratic Party nomination without the Black vote. Okay, I believe that there needs to be a greater engagement on the part of progressives of Black communities in the South and throughout America, and connection with them long term, not just when it's election time. I believe I can be part of helping to make that happen. My whole early adult life, I've been committed to dealing with issues of race, and I have interacted with my people as part of that consistently, and organized with people like myself. As part of that, progressives need to do that, because if they don't, then I think we're right to say the audacity of progressives to think you can win the presidency without the Black vote.
I like the idea of audacity of progressives, meaning that the change just can't wait. So you successfully lobbied the University of Maryland while you were a student there to change the name of the stadium, because it was named after a former university president who had been a staunch proponent of segregation. In an article in the Baltimore Sun, I see you quoted as saying that we should try to steer clear of performances of wokeness. And I really love that phrase. But how do you decide when a name change represents something meaningful, and when do you consider it just performative?
Well, look, if the name change is to substitute actual public policy changes, right, is a substitute for actual substantive public policy changes that really help move the needle on whatever it's about, then that is performative wokeness, right? I'll give you two examples based on name changes that happened that same year, although there's other things that we could talk about, right? So that year, we advocated for the name of the University of Maryland's football stadium to be changed. Of course, that guy was bad news on many fronts, right? But the irony to me, and this will get into another aspect of my platform, is that I don't believe that to this date, the university has made a substantive commitment to increasing Black student enrollment and also Black student achievement on that campus, undergrad, grad school, et cetera. So for me, as much as I appreciate that name change, it hasn't been accompanied with something that's substantive that speaks to why we wanted to go at that legacy, right? The legacy of saying, look, you are Black, you can't come here, right? Need not apply, right? They said that not just to, you know, random people. They said that to Thurgood Marshall, right? As a result, of course, he ultimately sued many different campuses of the University of Maryland, professional schools, et cetera. And ultimately, that culminated in the case of Brown versus Board of Education, which we know is a landmark decision that ruled segregation in public schools unconstitutional. But to this date, we are still seeing that predominantly white institutions are allowing racism to be alive and well on campus without trying to check it. We're still seeing hate crimes, massive hate crimes on college campuses, including University of Maryland. Great example, or I should say bad example, Sean Urbanski killing Richard Collins, right? There's a culture on these campuses that the administrators need to be dealing with. And I don't believe that substantively they have been, right? At least not adequately, right? You know, I don't think anybody that went to Maryland during the time I was there would be surprised by Sean Urbanski killing Richard Collins, right? Because you saw enough to know, you know what, that's kind of how things happen there. Not that exact incident, but you know that's how thinking is for a lot of people there. If you know about racism in America, you were appalled by what you saw at the U.S. Capitol, but you can't be that surprised, right? You know that that fits the character of America. It shouldn't, but it does.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
It has to change. Mm-hmm. So that is an example. The other building that I would speak to is the Perrin J. Mitchell building. They named the Art Sociology building after Perrin J. Mitchell, the first African-American congressman from Maryland. And he was also the first Black graduate student at Maryland. Well, his biggest thing was Black business supporting minority businesses when he got to Congress. Well, one of the hypocrisies that I pointed out is that as they were doing that, they had not made any commitment to increasing their minority business inclusion and participation and supporting, making sure, look, their percentage was way down in the gutter. And so if we're going to honor Perrin Mitchell, we need to make sure we're coupling that with honoring his legacy from a substantive standpoint as well. That's what I meant by that. And there's so many other things, right? To this day, right, they renamed the football stadium, but to this day, you have a modern day form of slavery on that campus and on college campuses across the country, which is the refusal to pay college athletes who generate millions of dollars for the campuses.
That was my next question. I want to hear your pitch on why we should pay college athletes. So go ahead and fill us in there.
Sure. So, I mean, look, it's very simple. Look, I respect, and this is another thing with progressives, right? So I love progressives, and I love how we focus on labor, raise the minimum wage, right? You know, protect workers, collective bargaining, all of these things, right? But I believe that without understanding the racial lens and without focusing on the racial lens of the labor issue, you can miss things like the injustice that is the NCAA, right? You can miss that. You can miss that. And so the NCAA has for decades, for a very long time, exploited mostly Black athletes, frankly, in basketball and football in particular, but beyond, who labor on fields and courts and generate millions of dollars for their respective program on an annual basis to the tune of basically over the 4-year period. There was a study that came out of Drexel University, Ellen Staworski of Drexel University, that said that over a 4-year period, the NCAA robs predominantly Black families of generational wealth, of billions of dollars in generational wealth. And the reason that I care about that issue probably more than a lot of other people is, frankly, I'm from Prince George's County. And as I say, local issues matter to me. So if you understand Prince George's County, PG County, we were in a documentary last year called Basketball County on HBO. which talked about how we have so many talented people from this county who ultimately make it to the NBA and who excel in the NBA, the most notable of which being Kevin Durant. Mm-hmm. But short of Kevin Durant, there are so many other Prince Georgians whose families send them to these schools to make these schools millions and millions of dollars. And they're being robbed of that wealth. Because the NCAA, look, if we're concerned about corporate greed, then we have to be concerned about Mark Emmert and the NCAA. We have to be concerned about these athletic directors and these football coaches and these basketball coaches and all of these athletic programs that exploit the heck out of these athletes. And we're okay with it because it's quote unquote a game. We're okay with it because, oh, they're student athletes. We know that's a myth. We know that these are athlete students if you look at the hours that they're required to put in for one versus the other. And even how the importance is placed on one versus the other for these kids in particular. We are sleeping on that, and we should not be sleeping on it.
Thank you for bringing that to light. So I'd love to talk about your record in Greenbelt and on the city council and as mayor. And in particular, let's start with your efforts at police reform. What have you identified as the top issues that need to be addressed? And what have you and the city council been able to accomplish in terms of police reform?
Sure. I mean, I'll be very candid with you. This has been a challenge, right? And this gets back to what I was saying earlier about why I got involved, right? Why I got involved is people who have elective office not doing what they need to do and causing problems for people beneath them, whether it's state legislatures causing problems for counties and cities, the president or the federal government, congressmen causing problems for people at lower levels of government, or whether it's cities, city leaders causing problems for the people in their communities, and so on and so forth. So I'll tell you this. We've actually had a very difficult time advancing police reform legislation here in the city over the past year or so, because guess what? The state legislature here in Maryland has two really problematic laws on its books that basically neuters anything that we could do that would be substantive and meaningful to address the issue. One is the Maryland Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights. It is the biggest obstacle to police accountability in all of Maryland policing. And that's on the books. And by the way, that law, that Bill of Rights in Maryland was the first Law Enforcement Officers Bill of Rights created in all of America. And guess who was in the Maryland State Senate when it was enacted and supported it? None other than the Honorable Steny Hoyer.
Wow.
He helped create the national model for police accountability. And to this day, that hampers local government's efforts to enact meaningful police reform. Right. That's number one. And investigate and discipline officers who have engaged in wrongdoing. Without that, we're not going to be able to do anything if we have to dance around that. Right. Nothing meaningful. The only thing we can do is use of force stuff. And we've done that. Right. We can change that. But when it comes to if you violate those policies, the investigations that are handled by a Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights, we can't change that until the state acts. And Steny started that crap, right? That's number one. Number two is the Public Information Act. So that is the biggest issue when it comes to police transparency, right? We have a police transparency problem in Maryland that's worse than what you have in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis, after they killed Floyd, you could actually go and see what that officer had done. Not everything. There were things you couldn't see, but you could see some of the disciplinary stuff. Because of our Public Information Act and the exemptions in it for officers and how it, you know, exempts these disciplinary records, you can't see any of that. And that creates a problem for accountability. And also, like I said, transparency and by extension, trust. But, you know, we have one of the best mental health departments and we probably have the best mental health department in the state, our CARES program. So on mental health and mental health calls, we are making progress there. In our next budget, we will be making some significant adjustments to invest more. And so that right there is something that I'm very much grateful for. You know, but there's things that need to happen again at higher levels of government for us to really be able to have an impact, especially now that our budget is tremendously being strained by the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the economy and by extension, local government's tax revenues. Yeah. One other thing I want to say on police reform and I guess this will tie into what we were just talking about, right, is the BREATHE Act. I support the BREATHE Act, which was sponsored by or pushed by Ayanna Pressley and the Movement for Black Lives. Steny Hoyer has not signaled that he would be supportive of that. That is problematic because if we're going to say Black Lives Matter, we need to be listening to Black Lives Matter when it comes to our formation of public policy around police reform. Look, public safety can't just be something that we address through jails, all right? It can't just be something we address through handcuffs, right? It has to be understood as a problem that is solved by serving other social problems in communities.
Sure. So what are the top issues that you've identified that you think the constituents that you're running to represent care about? So like, what would be your priorities if you are elected to Congress?
Education is one of the top issues in my campaign, right? So on education, we need more investment in mental health, in counselors, right? We need a step back from this over-policing of schools, right? There are some schools where they're really dangerous. I understand the debates that are ongoing about this, but the reality is there is a massive over-policing of schools in this country. And there's a massive underinvestment in mental health, in public education, in this country, in this state, in this county, right? That's number one when we talk about education. Number two on education is our teachers in America are vastly underpaid. We need to raise teacher pay. I know there are a number of different ideas out there about how we do it. Set the salary floor at $60,000. I'd support that. I think, frankly, maybe it should be even higher. Of course, if you're going to set any, you know, wage policies, you need to index that to inflation, that type of thing. But, you know, what's interesting when we talk about education, Mr. Donahue, I think that there is a lack of attention being paid to the issues that not only impact K-12 education, the policy issues, but the issues that impact higher education. Canceling student loan debt, that absolutely needs to happen. Look, college is way too unaffordable. We need to have tuition-free public colleges, and we need to make sure that we cancel student loan debt. Folks are not even able to get off the ground in this generation because of student loan debt. This is a unique problem to this generation. Older generations don't necessarily appreciate it as much because they went to school when school was $5 a pop. Now, I'm joking, but it was very different. Right. Now, education has become much more of a necessary pathway to higher education, much more of a necessary gateway to economic mobility. And so more folks are pouring in, coming out, but you got less jobs and you got less high paying jobs. You got people that are very well educated in a formal sense that are very underpaid in a literal sense. That has to change. So those are some of the things that I'm thinking around education in particular. But, you know, there are other issues. I'm opposed to the maglev. You know, we need mass transit. We need greater investment from the federal government in mass transit. But the maglev is a project that is basically mass corporate welfare. Right. This is a project. It's a high speed train that's supposed to run straight through my community. And it's being touted as environmental. Is anything but, right? It would go through forests, it would go through parks, it would go through federal agencies, it would go through residential neighborhoods, devastate our community here in Greenbelt and throughout the county. And Steny Hoyer is not opposed to that. Why? Because his buddy Wayne Rogers is the former Maryland former chair of the Maryland Democratic Party. He's donated to Steny and he's got him in his pocket. And he's pushing the maglev. Right. He's the CEO of Northeast Maglev. Right. We need greater investment in mass transit, less investment in mass corporate welfare. Maglev is a great example of what we should not be doing around transportation. Right. We need to tax the rich, Mr. Donahue. I mean, look, we have billionaires all throughout the country. I mean, we have people that have so much money that they could pay for my city's budget for the next 50 years easy and wouldn't even break a sweat. I guess the last thing that I really want to mention on just what I'm focused on is you know, we have corruption in America in a literal sense and in the sense that everybody recognizes, taking money bags on the table. But then we have corruption that people don't want to call corruption, right? These big campaign contributions coming from big money to super PACs, that right there is an extraordinary threat to American democracy, right? It undermines the interests of ordinary Americans big time. That's why I support making sure that we reform campaign finance laws, but also making sure that ultimately, you know, we really look at our federal courts, you know, and I can get into that. But, you know, that's the other thing. The economy, big issue, universal basic income. I mentioned it before. This pandemic has showed us that we can't do the same old sort of capitalistic hands-off approach to promoting economic well-being in this country. Look, I mentioned before, you have people that are highly educated, unemployed, underemployed. This pandemic has underscored what happens to people who are one day gainfully employed and all of a sudden become unemployed, how the bottom falls out. There shouldn't be a bottom that can fall out in America. People should be able to sustain themselves. You know, we need to recognize housing as a human right.
No, I appreciate that. It definitely is an issue that I think needs to be addressed. And I think I've read somewhere that you brought up the fact that Steny Hoyer voted against Representative Jackson's reparations bill. But that leads me right into this next question, which is that the demographics of Hoyer's district have changed considerably over the years. He's been in there for over 20 years now, and it doesn't seem like his voting record reflects that change. For instance, that he didn't support Representative Jackson's reparations bill. Could you explain why the changing demographics in Maryland's 5th district make you better suited to represent it than Representative Hoyer?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, we are the diabetes capital of the world in Prince George's County, right? I don't support Medicare for All because I am a progressive. I am a progressive. But the reason I support it is because it is the solution to the healthcare problems that we have here in America, right? We need to be supporting Medicare for All. He does not. I don't think he understands or appreciates that this county is literally the diabetes capital of the world and all of the complications that come from that, right? The pandemic is underscoring just how important it is to have Medicare for All, right? For Black and Brown communities, of which there are many in this county. Right. So what I said on reparations is that he didn't co-sponsor the bill. But here's the other thing about him being majority leader. Right. As majority leader, he has power, certainly more power than the average member of Congress. Mm-hmm. So my biggest thing with Steny on reparations is that he promised to bring that bill to a vote on the floor and he never did. And we never asked no questions about it. See, look, my whole thing is to wake people up. Right. I talked about the American nightmare. Right. And the way we end the nightmare, right, is to wake up and rise up. So another thing that I've tried to focus on is waking people up. If the people wake up, I believe they will rise up and send Steny packing. But we have to do a better job of waking up people. But I believe that Steny Hoyer has exploited that. Right. He has taken advantage of that fact that, hey, look, you know, they don't care that I didn't bring it to the floor. Right. A lot of people probably don't even know that. Right. And he's taking advantage of it. And so we have to say, look, no, you can't do that. You can't do that. We're watching. We know now. And we don't want to continue to have that. Look, if we have reparations, that impacts the majority of my county. The majority of my county would have more money coming into their pockets. His not supporting UBI, that is in part going to have racial impacts, right? His support for $600 stimulus checks versus $2,000 until Donald Trump called his bluff, right? That has an impact across racial lines that's disparate, right? The fact that he's okay with the fact that Joe Biden is pushing $1,400 stimulus checks versus $2,000 stimulus checks, that has a disproportionate impact on Black people, right? I mean, Black businesses were shut out of the stimulus, the CARES Act. You know, we saw all of these random places that you say, how did they get money? I mean, you saw crazy businesses getting money. I mean, businesses that didn't need nothing. And then you got small black businesses in my community. Some of them self-employed type. Stanny is about good old boys politics. I'm about good trouble. As much as I'm a progressive, I actually like John Lewis, right? I know progressives mad at him for endorsing Hillary over Bernie, right? And I supported Bernie. I was a delegate for Bernie Sanders, right? Supported Bernie again in 2020. But look, John Lewis's contribution to this country were tremendous, right? I consider myself very similar to him, right? In the way we came up through activism. You know, he opposed the Iraq War. He opposed the 1994 crime bill. Stanny supported it. That is something that speaks to this district, right? You know, literally just yesterday, like so many things I could tell you, Mrs. Donahue, right? Literally just yesterday, Dustin Hicks was executed by the federal government. And a lot of people will look at it and say, you know what? That was the 13th and final federal execution by the Trump administration. But if you know what I know, then you know that that execution wasn't just by the Trump administration. That execution was in part due to the policies enacted by and supported by Steny Hoyer. Right. You know that that execution was authorized by the Federal Death Penalty Act of 1964, which was part of the 1994 crime bill that Steny supported. And by the way, this speaks to the race thing. When Steny was defending that bill on the House floor, Mr. Donahue, he was citing Giuliani. He was like, yeah, Giuliani's for this. Rudy wow. Giuliani.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's crazy. And we see that over and over where he cites our enemies for why he's doing something instead of citing our champions.
Mm-hmm.
He cited Liz Cheney on impeachment. I asked him to support impeachment the Sunday before the insurrection. Because I knew then when the president made that call to the Georgia Secretary of State that they were going way, way, way too far. They were already going way too far. But when I heard that, I said, they're going way, way, way too far.
Right.
And he ignored my requests.
Yeah.
I asked for him to intervene in the Dustin Hicks situation. That's mm-hmm. what I'm saying. Over and over, I'm giving him the great ideas. I'm giving him ideas that would save black people that are on death row, save people from this Capitol insurrection. Look, once Trump knew that he was about to be impeached, let me tell you this, Mr. Donahue. Once he knew that he was about to be impeached, he started mellowing his tone. He started calling for peace.
Absolutely.
What if we could have had that conversation about impeachment that Sunday?
Right.
And he told them to calm down then. We're talking about lives that are being caused by his inaction.
Yeah.
Right? By him just ignoring and disregarding stuff. Right? And so, and these are black lives. Right? But actually, his life was almost at stake with this, right? So now he cares about that. And he gave that stirring speech on impeachment on the House floor. And all I'm saying is great speech to some people. I didn't think it was that great, but to some people, great speech. But Mr. Congressman, you're a day late and a dollar short. I asked you to do that Sunday. Right. And he was one of the last House Democrats to support impeachment. One of the last House Democrats after Hakeem Jeffries, after Catherine Clark, after Nancy Pelosi. Right. After Cori Bush, after Jamal Bowman, after AOC, after Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, you name it. They were there before him. He's not a leader. He's the House Majority Leader. He's the House Majority Follower.
Well, Mayor Byrd, we have a listenership that I feel is really eager to help, especially candidates like you who represent change. We've had other candidates on the show who have reported receiving support from our listeners after their interview aired. If our listeners want to help you in your bid to win this upcoming race against Steny Hoyer for Maryland's 5th District, what can they do?
Well, thank you for asking. I mean, look, if they would like to support, there's a lot of different ways to do it. You know, but the simplest thing I can encourage you to do to just get plugged into all of those ways is you can reach out to me. I'm a very accessible guy. That's been my whole thing is be accessible and be responsive. Everything else issue-wise flows from that, right? And so my email address, colinabird@gmail.com, colinabyrd@gmail.com. Reach out. Let me know that you want to support. We can make sure that, you know, we let you know about how you can volunteer. But, you know, another big thing that you could do without really having to break a sweat, even though it might cost you a couple pennies, is you could donate, right? You know, follow me on Twitter, at Mayor Bird, at Mayor Bird. And you can get connected with me that way. We got the donation link right up there at the top of the page. Real nice and easy for you. You know, just get connected with me, though. I'm on Facebook.com/VoteColinBird. Facebook.com/VoteColinBird. That's B-Y-R-D. Why? Look, I know that this is a tough time for anybody to be donating their money. And that's why, at the very least, I ask that you donate your time if you're supportive. Another thing is on Twitter, look, don't just follow me. Look, what I would ask you to do is, like, retweet, right? Retweet. Yeah. Because I'm trying to – I need – look, I'm very realistic about the challenges that I'm facing in this race. And one of the challenges I'm facing is this is a guy with a lot of name ID throughout the nation, right? I need to make sure that I make up that guy. My city, my community, they know me. They know what I'm about. But the district as a whole and the country as a whole, I need to get it cracking on that level as well. You know, look, I just started my, if I'm being honest with you, Mr. Donahue, I just started my Twitter account this month, early January. And that's because for most of my time in service, I've been fighting for the people in the streets, not in the tweets, right? I got the message, right?
Right.
I just got to bring it to more people.
Yep. So follow at Mayor Bird, and then
at Mayor Bird.
Make sure you're hitting that retweet to get his message in front of as many people as we can. So thank you so much, Mr. Mayor Bird, for coming on and doing this interview. We're going to be watching. I appreciate the honesty in your conversation. I appreciate your vision. I feel like you see the issues and you have an approach. You have a plan on how you're going to address them. And I really appreciate you coming on the show to talk about that. I think a competitive primary is always good for the party. And I applaud your willingness to run against someone who is just so firmly established as a congressman. So I want to wish you the best of luck, Mayor Bird.
Absolutely. Thank you. Shout out to Bernie Sanders. Shout out to AOC. Shout out to Jamal Bowman, Corey Bush, Ayanna Pressley. Shout out to the whole squad, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib. You know, those are some of my heroes. I just want to make sure I say that because they're really inspirational. I love the work that they're doing. And while I'm gonna bring my own flavor. That's kind of what I try to model myself after. And there's a little bit of me in them, and there's a little bit of them in me. But I'm gonna bring my own flavor, and you know, we'll be humbled and grateful for your support as we take this next step.
Absolutely, thank you.
Wow, Pat, that was a really good interview. I'm really impressed with Mayor Bird. I didn't know about him until you told us, you know, weeks ago that you had him lined up for an interview. And when I heard the interview, and I, you know, did a little reading, obviously, up on him, he's just an impressive person. He's, you know, an impressive human being. 27 years old. So young, obviously, incredibly talented, incredibly brilliant, will be a leader, maybe president one day, who knows. But I was, I was really impressed. A couple things obviously stuck out to me. I appreciated his point about, you know, the slight jab, I guess, on Obama with Obama's message of hope. And, you know, his opinion of that was that there was too much hope. It was overhoped, and that we need to, you know, put some action behind just hoping all the time, obviously. And I get that. I mean, and, you know, I think you would agree that there is definitely a place in history for Obama and with respect to that message and how relevant and how important that message was for the time. But yeah, I mean, several other points. The NCAA modern day slavery. Yep, I'm with them all day on that topic.
So you're okay with the idea of paying college athletes?
Like, absolutely. I mean, you know, and he cited that you know, that important Drexel study that highlighted the billions and billions of dollars over the course of just 4 years that could be, right? If you talk about the wealth, the money that could bring into a student athlete and what that would mean in terms of generational wealth, you know, years and years and generations down the line. it's effectively robbing them of that opportunity, of those opportunities. We all know student athletes.
That was striking.
Yeah, student athletes is just, that name doesn't even, it doesn't even make sense anymore today.
Right, and he rightly points out that it, you know, it's athlete students because they spend so much of their time training for their respective sports, and they really, I mean, not for every, you can't say this for every one of them, but they, you know, sometimes the student piece of that, it becomes somewhat of a formality.
Yeah, you know, I found him to be incredibly thoughtful, honest. You know, when you asked the question about police reform efforts. You know, one of the things that he mentioned was, you know what, honestly, this has been one of the hardest things. Obviously he's dealing with two major roadblocks. You know, one of them is the Bill of Rights, for, law enforcement officials, that, you know, when that was brought into law in the state, when Steny Hoyer was in the state Senate at that time. Thought that was really really nice little jab there. That was very, very poignant. And the second there being the BREATHE Act, that Steny Hoyer has not supported either.
But I also thought, like, Mayor Bird's point in being so honest about, you know, as mayor, he said, you know, it's been tough and we haven't done nearly as much as I want. That is so honest, and it stands in such stark contrast to the picture he's painting of Steny Hoyer and other people in Congress who just really don't stand up and aren't accountable for the things they do or don't do, mm-hmm. right? So, like, he's painting that picture of, like, this is why I'm involved. I want, you know, a leader who is accountable for their decisions and their actions. And then I ask him a question, and he comes right out with the honest answer, just modeling that behavior that he says is missing from other people in Congress. I thought that was, you know, pretty
absolutely
powerful.
I mean, all his entire platform is 100% in keeping with, like, today's progressive movement. I mean, there's no denying that it's perfectly in line with, you know, that, you know, AOCs and the Ayanna Presleys and the Bernie Sanders and, you know, the Elizabeth Warrens of the world today. Impressive. I thought he hit all the notes.
Dan, what were your thoughts on Mayor Bird?
Yeah, a lot of what Lowe said as well. He's a very impressive guy. And obviously he's just starting out in terms of his political career. But very reminiscent, I think, like his approach to politics of like an AOC or most recently Jamal Bowman up in the Bronx, who was just sworn in a few weeks ago. And he went up against Elliot Engel, who had 16 terms, and very similar, just like not representing the people who put you in the office. And I think you made the point, Pat, about accountability. You know, Congress isn't really accountable right now. A lot of Congress people are not. And mayors, you know, everyone knows where the mayor's office is. If something ain't right, you're going to go downtown and you talk to him about it.
Right. And it's a smaller town too, Greenbelt. So he absolutely is, I think, probably much more in face-to-face conversations with the people of his city than, you know, even a mayor like a Mayor Walsh would be.
I think the big thing for him is going to be like where he raises his money, because I'm guessing Steny Hoyer has a couple corporate friends.
Yeah.
Right. No, I mean, that might be a, he's up against that big
money wall.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, but we see, you know, we've seen with AOC, with Cori Bush, with people, you know, across the country at this point, that if you can develop, you know, cultivate enough support from your constituents, it really sometimes doesn't matter that gap in terms of money raised for, specifically for House seats like that, I think that's where it you can actually play more on an even footing than, you know, a nationwide race where you really do, you just absolutely need the cash to make sure that your ads are running across all markets. So I really do wish Mayor Bird the best of luck. And what's kind of fun is that, you know, we've got now almost 2 years to watch this play out and to watch how he sets up and runs this race, and hopefully Steny Hoyer will agree to, you know, debates and stuff like that, and we can track those as well. So This will be kind of fun to track him, and I do hope that any listeners who heard what he said and felt moved to either donate money or, you know, once it gets closer to the wire, actually picking up the phone for him or text message, doing some campaign action for him. I would love to hear about some of our listeners getting involved there too.
So who we got coming up next week, Patrick?
So I will just leave it at, we are going to be discussing universal healthcare and Medicare for all, and kind of where that stands right now. We're going to talk about whether or not it's going to make more sense to have that done at the state level versus at the national level. And we're going to have an expert, or hopefully potentially two experts, talking to us who are involved in that fight and have been for a long time. And so it'll be really good to really get into the weeds there and understand kind of the fiscal arguments in favor of universal health care, the arguments about outcomes, health outcomes, and also, you know, just like where we stand in that fight and where that fight looks to be going in the next 2 years versus the next decade. Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message. That's 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.